When we think about the future, we often think about technology, more smart devices, and artificial intelligence making our lives more digital and virtual. But our next guest says that the time we spent more isolated during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic reminded us how much we value human interaction and getting to spend more time with other people face to face. He says it's an opportunity now to think carefully about what we want technology to do and not to do for us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on how we use, maybe misuse, our online technology coming out of learning at home? For some people, working at home, what did you like about that? What did you not like? Did you find yourself really yearning for more human connection? How have things changed for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Sachs is a journalist and freelance writer whose work appears in outlets like the New York Times, Bloomberg, and the New Yorker. He's the author of 5 books. His latest is called The Future is Analog: How to Build a More Human World. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back to before COVID. You write about this notion, sort of a techno-utopian idea that we're going to get more digital stuff, more virtual stuff. We should use as much of it as we can, and it's going to make our lives better. I'm oversimplifying, maybe. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think this is something that goes back decades, if not even before, right? It's this human cycle of invention, which is a very, I think, a particularly American thing, that there is a new technology that's coming out, and this is going to make such sweeping changes to our lives that it's going to completely reorganize the way we live in the most wonderful colored way. Or the flip side of it's the kind of dystopian Terminator version of that. And for decades, this was kind of the defining way we spoke about the future. But in the past couple of decades, and especially really the past 10, 15, 20 years, with the sort of advent of the internet and smartphones and all the things that have come with it, it's really kind of captivated every level of our discourse around the future. And to the point where, you know, the term "the future is digital" was just kind of this accepted gospel of the way we were going to live and sort of our predestined path forward.
And here came COVID. And the heart of your book is looking at this as this accidental experiment where we tried this digital future on for size. You break it down to a lot of different realms in our lives. Big picture, though, what did we learn?
Well, I think all of us around the world, except for some people in New Zealand for a few months when they kind of skated away before it hit them, we every one of us was kind of forced to live or interact in the key parts of our life through digital technology almost exclusively for weeks or months or even years at a time, depending on where you live. I mean, if you're in China, you're just coming out of this right now. And so while before the sort of notion of the digital future was this far off, you know, fantastical kind of utopian thing, all of a sudden it's April 2020 and we're all living through this. We are all working online unless our job required our bodies to be there, whether you're sort of an ambulance driver or a doctor or a construction worker or, you know, cooking in a restaurant as an essential worker. Every child from kindergarten through to, you know, graduate school of university did their schooling online for, again, weeks or months or years. And everything. I mean, you know, the way you would interact with family, you would have a reunion with your friends, you would shop or you know, have a restaurant meal. All of it was done through screens, through technology, through the internet, right? That digital future of like, in the future, you're going to live at home. You're not going to have to wear hard, difficult pants. Everything you're going to do is going to be on your screen. It's going to be this wonderful thing. You're going to exercise. You're going to pray. You want to see a concert. That concert is going to be beamed right to your fingers. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, right. This is it. This is what I'm living. And I think for most people, that got old pretty quick. We saw the limitations of that. We saw where that was insufficient and where the analog, by which I mean the non-digital spaces, relationships, and interactions of our life actually seemed more valuable. We came to realize that. And that's really what this book is about, what we learned from that experience and where we saw those limitations.
Talking to David Sacks about his new book. It's called The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you'd like to share your experience, maybe early in COVID days, doing a lot of things online that you might have done in person, were there things you thought worked better? What did you miss? Did it reaffirm the value for you of seeing people in person, doing things, going to work in person, if you're one of the people who worked at home? Love to hear your experience, your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, let's go to work now. This is one of the chapters in your book where many people, not all, but many people were working online and discovered, you write, that we're missing something. What were we missing?
Well, I think it was all the things that are generally not thought of as quote unquote work, right? We think of work, and we were talking about sort of knowledge-based work. In short, work you can do on a computer in an office or at home, basically. And so we think of work as like, I must do these tasks on these programs in order to get paid my salary or my money or to achieve the things I need to achieve. And all the other stuff, the commuting time, whether you're driving or taking the public transit into work or walking, the coffee on the way there, the little meetings you might have that take some time in a room, or the short conversations at the water cooler or the coffee machine or on your way to lunch, all those are just kind of these extraneous things. The office, the sad potted plants, the neon lights, or wherever it is. Maybe you work in some cool place that's like a loft in Milwaukee or whatever. These are just kind of like the external trappings. We just got rid of that and got right down to the work, the sort of the meat of it, right? The economic activity. But actually, all those other things are the things that people miss. And it's funny, it's a lot of what people said is it was the things that they often complained about. Oh, another, you know, oh, Rob, another birthday. Like, come on, do we really need, you know, another sad cake in the lunchroom? Oh, Rob's, you know, making another joke again in a meeting. Oh,
no, people never miss that.
Yeah, no. You know, oh, someone's writing something on a whiteboard. And actually, what people realize is the things that they missed about work was not the specific task they could do. That they could do, you know, you could work on an Excel spreadsheet at home. You could work on an Excel spreadsheet in a park. You can work on an Excel spreadsheet in an office. It was all these other things that added up to something bigger. It was these physical touch points, the different information that you pick up when you're walking through a space. There was someone I spoke to, his name's Andres Hofbrauer, and he's an occupational researcher and in New York. And he studied, you know, the offices of architects, and he defined it as what was missing was this thing called embodied cognition, which is this larger understanding you get about ideas when you're in a shared space working with other people. And sometimes it's passing by someone's desk and seeing something pinned up or seeing something there. It's the snippets of conversation you have. All those things are the things that people actually realized had value, but only once they were sort of taken away and they were forced to just subsist on the tasks at hand.
Your solution here, you say we're having debates about should people who can work at home or work in the office or what percentage or whatever. You say that's not really the right question. And some of this applies to the non-work things too. You're hoping that we take this experience and just rethink, like, how do we work? Why do we work this way? What questions do you hope we start asking?
Well, I think the first is you know, what is the actual value of the spaces we have or the work we're doing, right? Or those relationships, and really assess them in a very critical way, because we can do many jobs remotely and we can do many things without having to commit to leasing a giant office space, and so on and so forth. But, you know, we're still stuck inside this 19th century industrial revolution model of, you know, you will go to this place and we will have your body in this place for this many hours. And for each of these hours, you will pay this many dollars. And that is productivity. And the reality is many people can work, you know, and do the same task in less time, in a greater amount of time. And most people, I think, just want to be treated as adults and given some sort of autonomy, which is a really difficult thing for large organizations, for bosses, for managers, for owners, sort of relinquish. But unless we have those conversations about what does it actually mean to allow people to work in the way that works for them? We'll never get beyond the sort of simple idea of like, is the office the future? Is working from home the future? Is it 3 days a week and Mondays, Rob, you're coming in, and Tyler, you're coming in, and Susan, you're coming in, but then the other team's coming in on Wednesdays. How are we going to coordinate that? Okay, we're going to have an all hands on Thursdays. So come with your best ideas on Thursdays. It's this sort of false narrative and this sort of dead end street that most businesses are trying to deal with now. And I think we need to move beyond that and say, what are the parts of work? What are the parts of this that we actually realize have a value by doing in person together in one space? What are the parts of it that it doesn't really matter where or when or how someone does it, as long as that work gets done? And how can we find a mixture that gives people that balance, that gives us the best of both worlds? Because I think the idea before is maximum efficiency is going to equal maximum productivity. And so if we can have everybody working either, you know, under my thumb while I watch them at the office, like some bad boss from a 1950s movie, or any movie really, or the opposite of everybody go home, everything's remote, and this is the most efficient way to do it, and then people are unhappy or disconnected in that way, what's the best mix? And that's going to be different for every organization, every group in an organization, every individual who's working. There's no one easy answer. It requires that experimentation. But this is what people are going to be figuring out for the next, I don't know, how many years or decades.
We're talking to writer David Sacks. His new book is The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. You could join in at 800-642-1234. In person versus online, what works for you? What doesn't? What do you prefer when it comes to work, learning, having fun, hanging out with people, seeing a show? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to David Sacks, author of the new book, The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you worked or learned or taught or had fun, recreated online a lot with the start of the pandemic, were there good things about it? What did you miss about interacting with people in person? Was it a big relief when you could do that again? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon. I am a teacher, and we did find out the hard way. Teaching is very much a human interactive person-to-person kind of activity, which is going to explain an awful lot of why we're seeing the educational COVID deficit in our kids today.
Kevin, thanks for the call. David, you're a parent. You've got a chapter about this.
Kevin, first of all, thank you for everything you do. I can't imagine how difficult it was for you as a teacher during those years. Certainly, I observed it with my own children who were in elementary school. I think this is you know, one of the areas where it was crystal clear where the future lies, and it doesn't lie in remote streaming video education. There's been billions of dollars poured into it. The best universities, the best minds worked on creating this future of school being remote and virtual. And I think what we saw is that it was a dismal failure all over the world, whether it was wealthy countries, wealthy schools, middle income. It didn't really matter. It didn't matter if it was public schools or private schools. It didn't matter if it was kindergarten universities. It really was a failure, and the data has come in to show that on learning loss, on engagement, on emotional engagement, on the mental health of children of different ages. And the key lesson is there is a difference between information delivery and teaching and education and knowledge. Information delivery is what technology, whether it's radio or television or the internet, does really well. If I want to find out a particular fact about something or learn about a particular thing, I can find that information out very easily. It is at the tip of my fingers. I can type it in and watch videos and see all sorts of things about it. But education is built on relationships, human relationships, the relationships between a teacher like Kevin and their students, the relationships between the students and their peers and each other, and the relationship between the school and that community that it's in. And I think if any of us think back to the best teachers we had or experiences at school, whether it's, you know, kindergarten or if you went to, you know, University of Madison, Wisconsin, that experience is all about those human relationships. I don't remember very much of the particular facts or figures or things that I learned in school. I remember my teachers. I remember the peers. I remember that learning. And those relationships are actually what allow us to take the information that we're being taught and turn it into a deeper knowledge about being a human in the world. And I think we saw just how insufficient digital technology is in doing that. You need people to sort of facilitate that relationship, teachers like Kevin.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. We're talking to David Sachs. His new book is called The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. Back to your calls. Barbara is with us in Fort Atkinson. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think we have a generation gap, at least in the working world. I am 73 years old, and I work full-time, love my job, love the people I work with. And when I was home for 15 months during COVID, I was just so lonely and missing the people that I work with. And I ended up working like 16 hours a day because I could not separate my work time from my home time. But the people, the younger people, I would say maybe 30 and younger, they love working from home. And when we try to hire people, that's the first thing out of their mouth. Well, can I work remotely? So.
Barbara, thanks for sharing that. You're not alone, I think, in your experiences there. David, what do you think?
First of all, I'm qualified to speak on this subject because I'm someone who's worked from home for himself his entire career for the past 20-odd years. So I'm no expert in workplace anything, and that's my sort of caveat. I think what's interesting is there is this what I call generational generalization that people make. And I sort of hear it in Barbara's comment, which is that, well, the younger people, and it's usually anyone, you know, in their 30s or younger, right? The dreaded millennials, the Gen Zs, the Gen Alphas, I guess, that are coming up next to them. The assumption is that because they are a generation that has grown up with digital technology, this is kind of what they want. This is their desire. But the facts don't really bear this out. If that was the case, then all those children who were learning online would have thrived. And actually, they were the ones who really hated it the most. And you're seeing that in many workplaces. It's actually the younger people who want to go in for mentorship, to build relationships, to learn, because they live in a house with a bunch of roommates and they don't have the space to work. And conversely, I've heard from many people of Barbara's generation, the baby boomer generation, they love working from home. It's the greatest thing. They don't have to drive. It's more convenient and so forth. So it really is down to people's individual circumstances. And I would caution against making generalizations based around people's age or demographics or other sort of large things. You know, when you ask people, why do you prefer to work from home, or why do you prefer, you know, using digital technology rather than an analog alternative in this sort of way, it comes up in their answers. And that answer often has very little to do with their age or particular demographics. It's individual preferences, it's circumstances, it's, you know, I have a cat and I have to stay home with the cat, or I have young children, or I live really far from somewhere, or so forth.
Barbara, thanks for that call. Just a couple minutes, David, left. There's another solution here. The reaction that, though, the problem here is that our digital world wasn't good enough yet, and so we have projects like Meta, formerly Facebook, saying we'll have virtual reality so we can look like we're sitting in a classroom with our classmates and the teacher, or David, Rob, we can sit at a virtual coffee shop and talk. That is what's going to make this all work. You have thoughts about that?
Thoughts indeed, if not comments. The first one is, you know, if you're Mark Zuckerberg and you look at what's happening and you see how so many of these things failed and people were clambering to get out back into the real world, and your solution is, aha, I know what the solution is. The screens were not close enough to our eyes, and we actually just have to physically strap them on. And then, you know, you can be an eel and I can be an octopus, and we can be having this conversation, Rob, in sort of Wisconsin Public Radio virtual reality. it's almost a stunning lack of imagination to sort of see things that way. And the proof is in the pudding, right? Meta's stock is you know, down tremendously. And that's because no one is opting to do this. This has been out for a year. No one's buying these headsets. I think at some point it's like on average a day, there's, 200,000 people on this Meta thing using it. How many people listen to the show on average? Just asking.
Well, fewer than that, I'll admit.
But that's just Wisconsin.
Let's say
a Wisconsin public radio aggregate listenership is probably greater than the number of people worldwide using this virtual reality future, which bodes well for the future of public radio, I think, but doesn't bode so well for the future of this purported virtual solution. And why is that? Because we're still human beings. We still get our greatest meaning and connection and joy from the real analog world. We want to touch things. We want to smell things. We want to see people. This is the freedom that we were clamoring for during those years and months of lockdown. And I think that's the hard lesson that we have to take with us, right? We tested this out. We kicked the tires. We took it for a test drive. Parts of it worked, but that as an entirety of a vision of a future is not one that most people want to go forward with.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's David Sacks. His new book is called The Future is Analog: How to Build a More Human World.